Welcome to another episode of the Farcast, bringing you experts and insiders on Washington, Wall Street, and the world. And now here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome to the Farcast. I am Michael Farr. Thanks so much for joining us again this week. It is the 23rd day of February, and I have a cold. My voice is not changing. That might happen at age 61 here, where you go through puberty again. Well, I'll tell you something about being 61, folks. It is full of surprises. It is full of surprises. The things, little things you don't expect that your body surprises you with. Not a voice and a squeaky voice. So we'll see how well it holds out today on the Farcast. Thank you for bearing with me. Always so happy to be here with you all again. I'm going to tell you that I'm probably going to disagree with some of our guests today. I apologize for that. Not really. I just, you know, and it's wonderful sometimes when we disagree, because that's when you learn something. That's when you learn the other side of the coin. And listen closely when you hear us disagree about what we're actually doing about these things we believe in that would be different in our portfolios. That's really where the rubber meets the road for investors. So I think the big news is the Home Depot report, the Walmart report, where they said a couple of things. Home Depot said that their number of tickets, sales tickets, receipts, was down 6%, but prices were up 5.8%. So Home Depot didn't really have a big change to report in the end, because they had hiked prices. You remember that many of us on the Farcast, on CNBC, have told you that we need to have companies that have pricing power. You've heard it from Labenthal. You've heard it from Stephanie Link. We're looking for companies with pricing power. Home Depot had pricing power. Good. They also said they're facing a weakening consumer, and they think that they're net earnings are going to be down in the mid-single digits this year. Oh, one other highlight, they're raising wages, minimum wage across all Home Depots, and are going to spend another $1 billion employees' wages this coming year. Now, Home Depot's not raising those wages because Home Depot's sitting there thinking, let's go do something good for our employees right now. Numbers are tight. We're going to see a decline of our net earnings this coming year. So why don't we raise wages? Because those guys, no, they have to do it because they have to hold employees, which means that there's still pressure on those wages. They're still trying to have employees there. They can't hire them. Neither can anybody else because they aren't out there, and you've got to pay more. And that's that $1 billion that they're spending on those wages to keep employees is one of the big reasons you're going to see that margin decline. But there are two things driving those margin declines. Higher interest expense, because interest rates are up, borrowing costs are up, and then you've got those higher wages. And a company with debt outstanding probably doesn't have debt necessarily all maturing at the same time rates go up. So the debt that's going to mature over the next couple of years and is going to have to be refinanced is going to be refinanced at higher rates. It's a slower roll. It's not all going to hit this year, but it will add margin pressures. So I think a weakening consumer is still coming out there. We're working our way through what I still believe is going to be a recession, but other people disagree with me. And speaking of disagreeing with me, Jim Labenthal is a partner at Cerity Partners, is one of my dearest friends on Wall Street and one of the brightest stars in Wall Street's sky. Smart fella, listen to Labenthal on the Farcast. Welcome, Jim.
Michael, good to see you. As I always say, follow Farr. Yeah. I have to start by saying that was one big opening statement there, counselor. You seem to have litigated the whole case in your opening statement, but tell me where you want to go next.
No, I was hoping to shut it all down and we'll just go directly to Mahaffey now. I'm guessing that while I may have convinced the jury, counselor, I probably didn't persuade you. So would you please tell the jury what you think, and I'll endeavor best as I'm able to shut up.
Indeed, Your Honor. Listen, that was a very cogent synopsis that you just gave, and there was a lot of accuracies in there.
Were there inaccuracies in there?
No, accuracies.
Were there inaccuracies? You said there were a lot of accuracies. I'm just coming back counselor to say, were there inaccuracies in anything I said?
There were no inaccuracies.
All right.
There were some facts that I think are important. That
sins of omission, perhaps sins of omission.
Yeah, but not consciously,
about.
Not with a purpose, not with a malevolent intent.
Giving me a lot of credit.
You were focused on the consumer, Home Depot, Walmart. I acknowledge the accuracy of everything you've said. I would point out some things that create a bit of a muddle for all of us in terms of what the path is going forward. So some of these facts are employment is still very strong, very strong. I think the January employment report, the 517,000 jobs, was an outlier. I think that'll be revised down. But still, you know, if it's 300,000, that's an awfully big number. And the weekly jobless claims give a pretty clear indication that the labor market continues strength. Now, why is this important? Because consumption is buoyed by employment. Where I would worry significantly is in the situation that you just highlighted, but employment is weakening and people are being laid off and we're getting monthly job reports that show declines in the hundreds of thousands of jobs. Thankfully, we're not seeing that. Now, another item
yes
that
and
I
no.
think-
very- Yes and no, Jim.
All right, let me get the second point in here, and this will give enough for you to come back with me, to me with.
Oh, I have
inflation. And I know this is a little bit controversial, but inflation is coming down. Now, you will be excused, both Michael and the listener, if you say, well, wait a second. What about those reports last week? Those reports last week were for the month of January, period. End of story. You know, to the extent that fuel was a contribution, we've seen gasoline futures nicely coming down over the past month. We see rent continuing to come down. We see prices paid portions of the ISM surveys indicating that prices are coming down. So what I take from this, and I want to be clear, this is not a definite, this is what the indications are, is that the January inflation figures from last week that disappointed were a blip in an otherwise downward trend in inflation that we've seen over the prior 3 months, which I think we will see confirmed in the February figures that come out in about 3 weeks. And if that's the case, if the two things I just said are true, employment is strong, inflation is continuing to come down, then your worries, Michael, about the consumer may be misplaced. As accurate as Home Depot and Walmart were in what they said, they're predicting the future. And in particular, Walmart, when they say consumption is going to grow 2% this year, I have no idea in the world how they're predicting what the holiday shopping season for this year is going to look like, which is where they get the bulk of their sales. I have no idea. I think they're kind of licking a finger, sticking it in the wind and saying, hey, you know what? The macro environment could be challenging. Why don't we softball this? Why don't we sandbag this? And if we have to upgrade it later, we'll see.
I think intelligent management does that. And it's one of the reasons you want to buy companies and invest in companies that have experienced management teams to get you through periods like this. All right, Jim. The Fed, in what it is doing, is trying to destroy demand. They can't control the supply side of the equation that they believe is driving inflation. And they don't believe their job is done yet. So they continue to raise these rates. And even as these sort of data, as you say, on inflation are not increasing at as fast a pace, and the rate of inflation is indeed slowing, we are likely seeing the effects of rate hikes that perhaps happened in June. So we're still seeing more roll forward. They're continuing to raise rates. And my experience and what I've seen them do before is as all of these rate hikes start to catch up, they kind of kill and crush the current economy at some point. At some point, the Fed has the ability to crush that demand. And we haven't seen that unemployment figure rise. According to the work that I have done, it's around 5.25% unemployment, could be 5.5%, somewhere in there where wage inflation starts to equal CPI again. Wage inflation equals CPI and isn't a driver anymore of top line inflation. It's just a go along. So we're way away from that at 3.4, 3.6% unemployment. We still have a lot of job openings. That JOLTS number, 5.25 million more than the unemployment, those calling themselves unemployed looking for a job. So I see what's happening, but I also see the consumer running out of cash. And my big worry, I'm always focused on the consumer. If the consumer is two-thirds of the economy and the consumer doesn't have money to spend and can't keep up with the prices out there, your economy stops growing. That's kind of my whole point there. And it's hard to make a profit if you don't have people to come buy your donuts.
Okay. Boy, counselor, your second opening statement was rather prolific as well. I'm going to focus in on two parts of that. Very, very erudite, very thoughtful statement you made. In terms of wage inflation, round numbers, I'm using round numbers here. The labor report shows us that average hourly earnings are up about 4.5% year over year. Meanwhile, CPI, headline CPI, is around 6.5% year over year. Mm-hmm. The indication on that is just the simple math is that it's not wages that are driving driving inflation. But obviously, the Fed wants to make sure that wage inflation doesn't get out of hand. That's why they're focused on services ex shelter. They want to make sure that wages don't get out of hand. My point is simply that wages are not what's driving this equation, number one. Number two, I want to point out this comment that you...
I think the Fed's main worry is, I mean, almost above everything is wages right now. I think wage inflation has a huge amount of their focus. They're adding to it with the interest rates and the cost of money. But okay, I'm happy to disagree on that. Well, and you know, as Jim and I said before we came on air, and you all didn't get to hear this, one of us is going to be right a year from now, and one of us is going to be wrong. And Jim and I are still going to love each other, and we're going to go on to the next thing and say, "Huh," and see, Labenthal was right, and Farr was wrong. That's me being self-deprecating, by the way. I'm not really sure that's what we're going to hear, but I'm going to go with it for now. Labenthal was right, Farr was wrong, and as we go through this, we're not making any major changes to our portfolios. I think that's key for a bottom line there, Jim. I'm sorry to go back there, but what we're doing in our portfolios is still fundamentally driven research, and we invest for the long term. We're not traders.
I'm actually going to use that as a segue. I thought we might bring this up in the final segment of, you know, Fred and Ethel, what should you do? And maybe you'll edit this to put it at the back. But there's a very strong reason why you and I are not making strong changes in our portfolio to reflect our outlook. And it's simply this. The degree of confidence in the outlook has to be low. It has to be low. You've cited a plethora of facts that support your argument. I can support a plethora that support my argument, and they're completely opposite arguments.
Yes.
So what do? I certainly don't listen to Michael Farr and say he's lost his mind, you know, and I'm just going to discount everything he says. I don't think you do that with me. So we fall back on the simple truth of our profession, which is that you make money in the markets by staying in the markets. Now, you can only do that if you're invested in high quality companies. That if, Michael, you're right and I'm wrong and the economy comes a cropper, that you're in companies you feel relatively certain are going to make it through and prosper on the other side of whatever downturn occurs. That's very central to how we operate for our clients. And sometimes I get questions of, well, you know, do you hang on to your losers in your portfolio too long, or are you being nimble enough? And the answer to that is very simple. I have tried being more nimble than I am as a long-term investor. I have found it very disadvantageous to long-term returns, very disadvantageous. I think there are people out there who are very good at predicting short-term movements in the markets. There's very few of them, very few of them. I'm not one of them. However, identifying good business models, good business managements, good prospects for long-term growth in a stock, with humility, I say I'm maybe not as good as Michael Farr, but I'm pretty good.
He had to throw in one of those humility comments in there. He's just trying to keep up with me, folks. And he is as good. You know, a billionaire named Gould years ago, and I can't remember his first name or I would tell you, they asked him how he made all his money. And he said, well, I never sold anything. And there's really something to that. If you own really good companies, I used to look at investors when I was an early stockbroker, and I'd get these portfolios in from new clients and the people with real money. And in 1987, and to my, you know, 27-year-old self or 26-year-old self, I would look at these portfolios over $100,000, which looked huge to me at the time. They had positions in IBM at $2 a share. And when you looked at positions in IBM with a cost basis of $2 a share, you realized that they held those companies as they went up, and they didn't worry about them when they went down, and they just kept holding them, and they let those investment returns compound without selling and paying capital gains taxes. And these people had real money. We even had people at our firm when we started in 1996 that had cost basis with a date of May 15th, 2013. You know why, Jim? You know why May 15th, 2013? I'm sorry, 1913? It was the inception of the income tax. It was the inception of the income tax. And we had people who had inherited positions in their portfolios, and they were big positions. I mean, that's really fun to see. So if you buy good stuff and hold it, and then over this long term, stock market returns are around 7.5, 8% over a 10-year period, I'll take it. I'll take that. We've had a great period where we've had outsized returns. If you give me 7.5% over 10 years, my money doubles. I'm very happy with that. I don't know about you.
Very happy with it as well. Hey, Michael, when you were giving your last statement on the consumer and various awful things that are going on, I said I was going to bring up two things. I brought up one, which was wage inflation versus overall inflation. I think for our listeners, just so you know, we do this on Zoom, and both Michael and I might have been thrown from our conversational thread by the introduction of Professor Jeff Lacker, who's watching. And so, you know, I know I started sitting up a little straighter when he got on, and I'm talking about the Fed. So
he is a big deal. He really is.
He is a big deal. So all that said, I'm going to finish the second point. You had brought up declining cash on the consumer's balance sheet, and the corollary to which is the much talked about rise in revolving credit and credit card debt. And I have to point out a canard when I see it, not by you, but by the media in general about this revolving credit.
That what means done, by me, but he's going to blame the media. Go ahead.
Well, you know, you might take some insight from this. What you choose to do with my pearls of wisdom is up to you. You can feed them to the swine, or you can thread them into a necklace. Consumer credit, as often shown, has simply the balances have gotten back to trend line. But it's not that bad, because that trend line is almost always shown on a linear scale, which is completely wrong. You have to show it on a logarithmic scale, which shows that it's below trend. And, oh, by the way, if you put that consumer debt, that revolving consumer debt, as a percentage of GDP, it's even further below trend. So I'm not buying the consumer is in terrible shape argument. Now, you know, 6 months ago, 8 months ago, when gasoline was $5 a gallon, yeah, there were some problems. Eggs last month, that was a problem. But more problems are being solved in terms of inflation than are being created. And that should take the stress that we did see last year on the consumer down by a notch.
Jim Labenthal is a partner at Cerity Partners, a CNBC regular contributor. Listen to Labenthal, folks. Jim, thank you so much for being with us. And ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Jeffrey Lacker, the former president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond, a esteemed professor of economics at any number of universities, and one of the smartest guys we talked to ever on economics, is going to tell you whether he thinks I'm an idiot or Labenthal's an idiot. And he's going to do it really politely, because that's what he does. And we're going to hear what he says after his many years sitting in FOMC meetings, how they're going to go about voting, and what he thinks the temperature is inside the Fed, whether he thinks they've got it right or wrong. That's segment three today on the Farcast. Please stay with us.
Thank you for joining us this week on the Farcast. Now it's time for political analyst Dan Mahaffey and your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back. Terrific segment with Jim Labenthal. And I'm always happy to bring on guests when we disagree, particularly those as bright and experienced as Jim. This is a very reasonable, well-thought guy with, and so I listened to him. I just disagree with him. And as we said, one of us will be right. Our job, though, is to make sure that we steer and guide our investors and their portfolios to the safest shore through the least turbulent waters possible, that we help our investors achieve their goals. That's our mandate. That's our charge. That's what we have to do. We try to understand Wall Street, Washington, and the world here on the Farcast and see if we can gain insights as to how to interpret all of the things going on around the world and around the country and figure out what that might mean for the economy and especially Wall Street. To do that every week, we turn to Dan Mahaffey, who is a senior fellow, director of policy at the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress, and our senior political analyst on the Farcast. Welcome back, Dan.
Thanks, Michael. Great to be talking with you again.
Wonderful to have you here from Chicago. Thank you. Lots to talk about. I want to start internationally, and then I'd like to get to Nikki Haley, if we have time at the end, about her discussion about age, and how old is too old to be in politics. Corporate America's already answered that. It's about 72 years old. After the age of 72, you're typically off a corporate board of trustees for a public S&P 500 company, Fortune 100 company. You age out. If they can do it, why shouldn't we do it? Let's talk about that maybe at the end if we have time. The president showed up in Ukraine, and Vladimir Putin gave a speech, his sort of State of the Union. I called it the State of the Soviet Union, because that's what it's starting to feel like again. And I was over in the Soviet Union in 1990. I remember what that felt like. So, Dan, give us your take on what's happening in Ukraine and what's happening with President Putin.
Mm-hmm. Well, we actually hosted, our organization hosted a great conversation on what the militaries are doing. But there was a comment from that that I think is expanded, can be writ large for the entire Putin speech, which is he's surrounded by a coterie of people who think what Russia is doing right now isn't Soviet enough. They
yes.
think that the control of the economy, the isolation, going back to an army that just uses massive waves of humans and tanks, a closed economy. They're going to talk about, they talked about defense industrial production, going to triple shifts, almost a war economy. They want to get back into that Soviet, almost Brezhnevian mindset. And that's how they're going.
Dum, dum, da, dum, 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 da, dum, 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 dum. You can hear them just
singing,
kind of goose-stepping. Ghost stepping through Red Square, can't you?
Yeah, crazy Ivan. I thought I heard singing, sir.
Yeah, I think I heard singing. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Those were the days, my friend. And they were not happy days here in the U.S. when we were really worried about nuclear attack. When we had school children, I was one of them, climbing under our desks or going down to the lunchroom in case there was a bomb attack in Washington, D.C. We all had to go down to the lunchroom at Somerset School and get under the tables or something, because the lunchroom had windows all to the outside, but it was the lowest place in the building. Somehow we would, that I think there should be notes. This is where you can find the children's bodies because we didn't stand a chance if there were any sort of nuclear attack. That was, I'm laughing, but it wasn't, I want you to picture marching the seven-year-olds down the hall into the lunchroom because that's where they were going to be safe. And we had those drills regularly. That's not fun. We don't want to go back there, folks. This is when you need old people around to remind you that this actually happened and that they were there.
Yeah, from nuclear drills to mass shooter drills to we'll have nuclear mass shooter drills next. So what will be happening in school? But, you know, I think that's great that you bring up that historical example, too, because when you think of the peak of the late Cold War, the early 1980s, the Reagan administration, back then, we had split China off from the Soviets by then. It had already been a decade already since the Sino-Soviet split. Now, I think it's even more concerning because you see Beijing and Moscow getting closer together.
So talk to us about that. What does this mean? And will China really support them, or will they just act like they're going to support them? I mean, does a strong Russia serve the Chinese purpose?
Well, look, I think the Chinese wanted Russia to be strong enough to win this war and win it quickly. The problem is they haven't. Now China has been stuck with this war. It's been stuck with the anger of the Europeans, who they've been trying to smooth relationships with. But ultimately, China is moving closer to Russia. You see these statements, you see these visits. And the administration, I think you see the comments from Biden and others making it abundantly clear that we would see it as a red line if China started to supply lethal weapons or munitions to the Russians. Already drones, microchips, consumer goods, stuff like that is getting into China, into Russia from China. But a little bit of a devil's advocate here. If you took Beijing's perspective, they could just as easily say that many red lines have been crossed now that NATO is giving things like tanks, HIMARS, and possibly even aircraft to the Ukrainians.
All right, what's your take, Dan? Who's right here, and how does this play out? Let's cut through this for our listeners.
Well, what is the problem here is that we are seeing the autocrats come together. We're going to have to figure out how to be tougher with Beijing and Moscow at the same time. The Chinese understand that there are benefits for the resources and some of the technical acumen that the Russians have. This is a challenge for policymakers. And I'm disappointed when I see Biden not also talking about Xi at the same time he's talking about Putin. They might think that they have a chance to keep them somewhat separated, but they're getting closer and closer.
Did I see something that the United States was sending troops for troop exercises to Taiwan? Did I see that this morning?
This morning that we'll be sending more troops to Taiwan for training of the Taiwanese forces. Look, that's escalatory. It adds to the military front, but we also see the economic front. Despite China's, I'd say charm offensive of late, you still see the disappearance of influential executives and changing rules on the economy there.
What do you mean changing rules on the economy there?
Oh, well, so I think we saw this yesterday, the announcement by Beijing that they no longer want the Western big four auditing firms to do any business with their state-owned enterprises. Now, we've reached deals recently on what audit standards Chinese firms would have to meet to be listed in the U.S.
You mean firms like Pricewaterhouse and...
Yes, those ones.
All of those big firms, yep.
Yeah, okay. The so-called big four. They don't want them going near their state-owned industries. They don't want Western auditors seeing the financial data. They don't want that transparency. They don't want them looking under the hood. Now,
the curtain is coming down further, and we're not going to know
coming
what's
down
going
further,
on.
And also that these state-owned industries, their ties to the military, the nature of their relationships with the government, or even their underlying health, all these things are now being kept secret by the state.
One of the things at Farmiller in Washington, and here's where the Farcast gets back to investing and beyond economics, one of the things that we have never done and will not do is invest in foreign companies that don't report according to U.S. Accounting standards. Without that transparency, without that vision into those, without that visibility into those financials, you don't know what you're buying. And in a lot of societies and a lot of other cultures, these aren't capitalistic, free marketplaces. Plenty of markets around the world will think that you're an idiot if you would ever invest in a stock if you didn't have inside information, if you didn't get a tip. And when we represent as fiduciaries of other people's money, we can't go there. That's not a game we know how to play, nor would we be willing to play that sort of a game. So, as far as I'm concerned, they're removing themselves from a flow of capital. And one more point here. Our SEC and regulatory organizations that govern the transparency of U.S. corporations add to the value of U.S. corporations. Yes, you can be overregulated and have a drag there, but basically, when you invest in a company that's reporting in the U.S., that's the clear deal, that it's an honest report, and that begets a premium in the marketplace, because if you don't know what's behind those numbers, you're not going to pay as much for them. I don't care how good your tip is. So the system that we use in the U.S. is really should be used around the world, unless the government is trying to manage the economy and the message, which is exactly what's happening in China.
Exactly. Couldn't have said it better.
Thank you. Dan, it seems like Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin are becoming a bit closer. And I said it seems like, because if I'm China, I don't need a strong Russia. I just need a compliant Russia. Russia has a lot of natural resources. We share a border. I just want a lot of that oil. I need a lot of those natural resources. And as long as Russia doesn't stand in my way, I don't need Russia to do anything other than kind of get out of my way. So if I can make nice with Russia without actually making them strong, isn't that to my advantage? And will Putin see that coming or not?
Look, I think Putin doesn't care about that because he sees the West and the challenge of the West as the more acute threat. Kremlinologists have described it to me as they see the West as the urgent threat, but they see China more like climate change, something far off and slower moving. So that's how the, you know, the sense that Putin is kind of managing the relationship with China and probably would be his successor who is left to the ultimate strategic answer. From Beijing's perspective, you have it right. You want a pliant Russia. You want Russia to be that gas station and mineral depot. And you want them just strong enough to keep the U.S. bogged down in Europe and Europe forced to confront this issue. Because what it does is it's revealing, and unless we change our mindset, it's revealing that we don't have the ability to produce in wartime. We don't have that will to keep up that production. So how we answer that next phase of this Ukraine war will also send an important message to China.
Remember what Farr has been telling you, folks. China is changing the goal. The goal now is for this perfect ideal China, according to the vision of Xi Jinping, think Mao Zedong, and what China should be. And it is not an economic superpower. He doesn't care about the economics. He shut down Hong Kong. He's going after Taiwan. He's shutting down access to the numbers behind their industries. And trade with China will diminish and continue to diminish, and he doesn't care. This is a headwind to global growth and global economics. Just keep seeing this particular narrative unfold every day. Xi Jinping is not trying to grow their economy. And if you don't have an economy, you don't have a mission. You can talk about your mission all day long, but if you don't have a margin, you don't have a mission. Now, finally, and we've got less than a minute now, Dan, Nikki Haley announced for president, of course, a week or two ago, and she has now brought about the age issue and said the president, current president and President Trump and everybody else over 70 is too old to be president of the United States. Indeed, President Biden seems to be struggling to get around. He fell again trying to get on the plane, going up the stairs to the plane. Somebody's got the man needs help getting in and out of the plane. He's the president of the United States. I know he doesn't want to be seen helping, but if the president of the United States falls down those stairs and hits his head, the world has a problem. Certainly the United States has a problem. What am I missing here? And will Nikki Haley be successful with this age attack?
Look, the one thing that unites Donald Trump and Joe Biden is that they have spent more trips around the sun than any of these other candidates. And what that means is age is going to become the new term you're going to be hearing for the next few weeks, probably months in politics, because age is how you attack Biden or Trump without going after them directly. New generation, new leadership. There's a yen in both these parties for new people besides Trump and Biden. You see it in the public wanting new people. Age is the way to get at it without attacking them directly.
Folks, I'm 61 years old and I cannot run as fast as I could when I was in my 20s. And that wasn't fast, I assure you. I am not as strong and my reflexes and reactions are not as quick as they were when I was in my 20s. I expect that they will not be as quick when I am 85 as now when I am 61. I see that, okay? We say that you have to be 16 years old to drive a car. We say that you have to be 18 years old before you can vote or enlist in the military or marry. You have to be 21 before you can buy a beer. That I still don't get. You have to be 25 to run for Congress, 30 to run for the Senate, 35 to become president of the United States. We don't have a problem as a country constitutionally codifying some of these age limits. Why we're so panicked and scared about codifying some of our age limits as on our older population, I do not understand. And I am quickly, if I'm not already a member of that particular cohort, I'm getting there every day. So, and I think it's important. You don't want me at 80 years old as president of the United States, and 61, that would be the hardest job on earth. So I got to tell you, I think we ought to pay attention to this, whether it's be used for political advantage or not. Dan Mahaffey from the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress, our senior political analyst on the Farcast. Thank you.
Good to talk to you.
We'll be right back with Dr. Jeffrey Lacker, former president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond, Virginia. He is the best. Please stay with us.
Michael Farr and the Farcast are proud to support Heroes, Inc. Heroes supports the spouses and children of law enforcement officers and firefighters who gave their lives in the line of duty to the greater Washington, D.C. community. Their singular goal is to honor the supreme sacrifice made by these individuals by caring for their families. Heroes' work begins within 24 hours of the tragic loss and continues indefinitely. We invite you to learn more about Heroes' mission at heroes.org. We hope that you will consider supporting Heroes as they endeavor to honor those who protect us. That's heroes.org. Heroes, here for you, here for good. And now, back to the Farcast and your host, Michael Farr. We appreciate you listening into the Farcast this week. And now to introduce this week's special guest, here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back. Terrific Farcast today, starting out with Labenthal, then Dan Mahaffey, of course, giving us insights into Washington and the president's most recent trip overseas, what it means, and will he run, and what will that mean in terms of the country's economic future. But now, as promised, the great treat today, we get to hear from our wonderful friend, Dr. Jeffrey Lacker, former president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond, Virginia. An esteemed professor of economics. My God, is this man smart, and he's been inside the Fed. So welcome back, Dr. Lacker. We are so happy to hear you, see you, and have you with us again.
Well, gee, it's great to be on, but I don't know how I'm going to live up to that billing, Michael. So,
Well, yeah, really. Look, do me a favor, Jeff, and say something smart today, will you?
I'll do my best.
Everybody's counting on you. All right. I'm not going to give you the preamble and try to explain anything about my views on what's going on. The only thing we care about are your views. What's going on with the economy? What's the Fed doing? And do we go into recession or not?
Great question.
Thank you.
The Fed's been catching up for a year and a half after sitting on its hands over the course of the winter of 2021-22. And they've gotten to a point where the interest rate that they want to get to is within sight. And they're now entering sort of a different phase of policymaking. They were pretty coherent, pretty much on the same team last year. They all knew they had to get higher by a lot. And so they marched up pretty rapidly. But now they're getting to a point where some people want to stop soon, and some people don't think they need to stop soon or want to stop soon or ought to start stop soon. So now there's a little more contention visible within the committee. So at the last meeting, they reduced the rate of increases. They went up by 25 basis points. The meeting before that, they'd gone up by 50 basis points. And the minutes of that meeting came out yesterday and revealed that a few people wanted to raise rates by 50. Now, we already knew the two people on the committee had wanted to go 50. They came out publicly. Loretta Mester, a great friend and former colleague from the Cleveland Fed, and Jim Bullard, good friend and former colleague from the St. Louis Fed, both said that they wanted to keep going 50 because they think the Fed needed to get higher, and they didn't see why they should wait to get to where they ought to go. So in Fed parlance, when they say a few, they mean more than two. If the number is two, they say a couple. So if they say a few, they mean it's more than a couple. And that's what most of the media coverage around the minutes release yesterday afternoon was focused on. In addition, the minutes contained some language about financial market conditions, by which they mean sort of how far equity and bond prices had advanced in the month of January, just before the meeting. Remember, the meeting was 3 weeks ago. And their comments in there are guarded, as they always are in the minutes, but you can detect that they were somewhat peeved that here they were tightening policy, trying to dampen economic demand so that they can ease the pressure on inflation. And markets are going ebullient. Markets were pricing in them to cut interest rates later this year, which they have worked hard in the last few weeks to disabuse people of. And so you can detect a note of being peeved about it. So it was a sort of a hawkish set of minutes, a little bit more hawkish than the chairman's statements.
Where did that disinflationary term show up a couple of times that sent the algorithms nuts? I mean, it's like he wants to deliver the same message more softly, but why did he get softer there? What's he trying to do?
So it's undeniable that in the second half of the year, the headline inflation numbers on a month over month basis came down, so that inflation was prices, the overall price level was going up at a slower rate in the second half than it was in the summer in the first half. So that's technically disinflation. But he put some emphasis on it that was a little odd at the press conference. He said disinflation is underway, as if, you know, a truck is pulling out of the station. I mean, it's just the data's come in that way. And shortly after the press conference, we got the consumer price index numbers for January, and they were higher than expected. So the December to January price increases, kind of ticked up. And so that was a big disappointment. I mean,
would the FOMC have that data before the meeting?
No, they wouldn't. And so this is the danger. You get out and declare disinflation is underway as if it's some autonomous process. But, you know, the disinflation we saw at the end of last year was commodity prices, goods prices, where supply chain constraints have eased dramatically in the second half of the year. Things like autos and the like. And that's not going to go on forever. I mean, car prices can only go down by so much. And then on top of that, you know, you've got service sector, which is largely dependent on wages in terms of their cost inputs. And there's a substantial momentum. And Chairman Powell noted this at the press conference last time. There's a substantial amount of momentum in about two-thirds of the economy in terms of inflation. And so we just got some good results based on energy prices and some supply chain easing, but that's not going to go on forever. And the expectation is that the month-on-month inflation numbers, or, you know, three-month numbers are good to look at. That's going to probably firm at about where it is now, and maybe firm up a little more. So they still have an inflation problem. Inflation is still elevated. It's still high. And they've still got to tighten policy.
Well, I gave a speech at University of Delaware, my Delaware speech, which you were so kind to do twice as Fed president at the University of Delaware, really advancing the education that the Fed provides out to universities and to the public. Pat Harker was there, and he and I have become buddies over the years, even from when I think you gave a speech at the University of Delaware when Pat was president of University of Delaware.
That's right.
Back in the day. So, Pat, you know, we're off camera and we were talking about a couple of different things. He said, three more quarter point hikes and we're just going to leave it there. I mean, we're not going to, we're leaving. It's staying there for a while was number one. Do you think that's still the right thing to do? Is that the still the consistent narrative coming from the Fed? And are we going to end up in recession here?
Three more quarter point hikes would take the target range to 5.25% to 5.5%.
Yes.
I doubt that's going to be successful. It might be successful if they're lucky. But I think if they do that,
has to go higher, are you saying?
I think it's going to need, they're going to need to go higher than that. I think if they do that and wait, I think they're going to see inflation doesn't come down. I think they're going to see they're going to come to the conclusion later in the year in the fourth quarter that they got to go up again. So if they pause, they're going to have to, I think, go up higher. And I base that on past experience, on the historical run of data. And the thing to look at is, you know, how high real interest rates have to go. That's, you know, interest rates adjusted for the rate of inflation. So yes. It's what you make on your, in, you know, your fixed income investments after deducting a charge for compensating you for inflation.
Let me just take 1 second sure. there. If inflation is running at 6% and you're earning 5% on your treasury bills, prices are going up 6, you're earning 5, you're still losing basically 1% in purchasing
exactly right.
power by sitting
exactly
in
right.
five. Yeah. Okay, right. Thank you. Sometimes this economic stuff goes over my head, and so therefore I know it goes over Fred and Ethel's head. Fred and Ethel, we're right there together, folks. All right. So recession, Jeff?
So I think they're going to have to push interest rates up high enough to weaken demand. And it seems unlikely that they'll be able to weaken demand by just enough without tipping over into a recession. When that comes, I don't know. It sort of depends on their calls in the middle of the year. If they stick at 5.5, like your friend President Parker suggests, my former colleague, I think they're going to find inflation's staying pretty firm, the unemployment rates, the economy doing pretty well, not going to recession, but they're going to get dissatisfied with the fact that inflation hasn't come down, and they're going to have to move interest rates up higher. I think they'll have to move them up to, you know, over 6, 6.5, maybe even 7 to get inflation down.
Whoa. 7. Whoa. Oh,
could happen.
I'm sorry. My heart did a little more than skip a beat on that one, Dr. Lacker.
Well, but let me bring you back to real interest rates. So what they have done so far is bring real interest rates back to zero, which is where they started before the burst of inflation, before this inflationary surge at the beginning of 2020.
Yes.
Interest rates were about zero. And inflation was about 1%. So they've basically made up ground. They have not tightened policy. They have undone the easing of policy caused by the rise in inflation.
What would you be doing differently if you were Fed chairman right now?
I'd be preparing markets for first. I'd corral the committee into going 50 next time. And I think I'd prepare markets for a more open-ended path this year. I'd try and tamp down expectations, that they're gonna sit at 5.5. I think the other thing I would do is I would point to history. I would point to the data, and the Wall Street analysts and the media analysts would be all over it. And say, like, look, we had to raise real interest rates to 2% to get inflation down in the past. We're going to have to do that again, probably. So get ready for it. And I think by pointing to history, he can make it a less of a kind of a crapshoot month to month. I mean, what we're seeing now in market volatility has a lot to do with swings in expectations about what the Fed's doing. And that's the thing that I was worried about coming into this, that the Fed's not going to communicate enough or well enough, and it's going to be a rudderless ship out there, and people thinking, does the Fed think this porridge is too hot or too cold?
Does the Fed worry about the strength of the stock market? I mean, when they're trying to cool things off, and in the middle of Jay Powell's speech, when they hear a word like disinflationary and all of a sudden markets take off, is somebody paying attention to that? And does that concern?
So the trace was there in the minutes. I mean, it's sort of coded, but you could tell people were peeved that equity markets went up, because it's cutting against what they want to do. They want to tighten financial conditions. They want to dampen demand, but all of a sudden equity markets go up. People feel a little happier and they start spending more. And we've gotten this great spending in January. We're going to get a report on Friday about consumer spending in January. You know, it doesn't seem like their tightening has any bite yet. It doesn't have. It's like pressing on the brakes and you don't get anything,
This is a bit of a political conversation, but it didn't strike me as political with Pat Harker. He said, a lot of this labor problem that we have, this labor shortage that we have, those folks who are looking for jobs, 5 million fewer people looking for jobs than jobs opening right now, 5.5 million, something like that. It's a ridiculous kind of a number. When you hear that this company or that company is laying off 10,000 or 12,000 or 18,000, what the hell difference does that make if you got 5.5 million people, gap jobs opening, at 12,000? So he said this was a problem of our own creation. We shut down immigration, and it's into the millions of people now and potential workers for lots of political reasons. And political reasons aside, we're a couple of million workers shy, and it is a problem we can fix. Do you agree with that? And how would you go about addressing it in this politically charged environment?
Yeah, so I agree. I sort of half agree, half don't. So I agree, easing up on immigration restrictions would be a very good idea for the U.S. economy. Data is pretty clear that immigrants are good for the economy, good for the country. They bring skills, they bring energy. And given the shortage of labor, that's even another argument. Even without that shortage of labor, there'd be a good argument for easing immigration. Now, when he calls it the problem, that's the thing. So there's a lot of things that could ease.
I might have put words in his mouth.
Immigration is one tool you could use to address it. But, the fundamental problem is that a bunch of people left the workforce and don't want to work. They used to want to work. They don't want to work. And it's big in the 50 to 70 year old age bracket. So people withdrew during pandemic, found other things to do. The equity markets kind of helped them retire early. And it's kind of sticky. They're not coming back. And that is part of a longer run trend of the baby boomers retiring. But the policymakers in early 2020 fundamentally underestimated that process. They fundamentally erred in thinking that we had a lot of slack in the economy and that they could stimulate, till the cows come home.
Okay, Jeff, here's my question. Investors are desperate for this period of economic and market discomfort to be over with. Prior to every Fed meeting, there's some new narrative about, did you see that point of datum, or did you see this number? And here's why the Fed is going to change. Or did you hear what Jay Powell said in his speech in Africa? Because he sounded a little more dovish, and they're going to pause, and then they're going to pivot and start to ease rates by the end of the year. And then markets go up. You get to the Fed meeting, Jay Powell says, no, we're not. And we really, 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 really mean it this time. And that lasts for a couple of weeks and markets go down. This has been a long process getting into this. We went through a pandemic. The Fed threw everything at the markets and the economy that they could to keep the economy alive. and they were prepared to accept the consequences. It took us a while to get into this. They threw a lot of dynamite in. I've been saying this is going to take a long while to get out. What do you think? How long do we go through this period of discomfort? When will we be at that target 2-2.5%? And when again would the Fed ever next ease? And when will the U.S. economy be expanding again?
That's a great question, Michael. I think it's inevitable for investors and the investing community to focus intently on each month's data, because that's how you accumulate a bigger picture about what the economy is doing. It's also natural to focus intently on the Fed's intentions, because they have a big role to play in how this plays out. But I don't see us getting down to the kind of steady state inflation near 2% growth before 2 or 3 years from now. And it could go on for longer. I think that the Fed has this choice about rip the Band-Aid off and take the pain up front. And but on the other hand, they like to get it over too. They'd like to get away with this as little harm to the economy as possible. And that second urge is going to seduce them, is potentially going to seduce them, potentially lead them to not administer as much medicine as they need to, and as a result, draw out the process. Jay Powell's been very clear he doesn't want to do that. He wants to get this over with. But I fear it's going to be drawn out. But even if they go fast, it's going to be a recession. Recession will last a year, probably maybe start later this year if they were really aggressive with rate hikes this year. And we'd get back to low inflation maybe in 25 or 26. But it's going to be at least that long. So I'd say, you know, buckle up.
When does the Fed blink and say, geez, we're in this recession. Recession feels horrible. The political pressure is heating up on the Fed. All of the voices from Congress are, Charlie Plosser said, they come out and the word is fragile. Just the word is fragile from Congress every damn time you go through this. It's too fragile for the Fed to be doing what they're doing. Against all of that, you know, when we are in recession, will the Fed ease when we're in recession and say they've done enough and try to normalize rates at that point? Because stock market people will go and buy everything they can as soon as they start to hear the Fed's going to be there for them. We just become addicted to the Fed.
Yeah, that's a big risk. And it's what happened in the 70s, and it's what made the 70s so painful. They would take their foot off the brakes when inflation had come partway down, but not all the way. But unemployment was going up and they were under tremendous political pressure to bring the unemployment rate down. So Congress has been very mellow. I mean, the unemployment rate's 3.5%. What do they have to complain about now? But if they tighten enough to reduce inflation, they're gonna have to tighten enough to weaken the job market. And when the job market starts to weaken a little, historical evidence is that it sets off a process in which it weakens a fair amount and causes a recession. And when that happens, it's going to really test what Powell has said, that their commitment is to get inflation down, even if it's painful in the short run, because in the longer run, it's less painful.
I learn so much every time we get to talk with you. I know our listeners do too. Thank you so much. I mean, thank you for being with us, and I hope you'll hang around just a few minutes afterwards. Dr. Jeffrey Lacker is the former president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond, Virginia, was a voting member on the Federal Open Market Committee that set rates. These insights are precious, folks, and I'm telling you, you're not going to get them anywhere else. Thank you for listening to the Farcast another week. We will be back next week as we do our best to cover Wall Street, Washington, and the world, bringing you insights, information, and some of the smartest minds we can find. Thank you so much. I'm Michael Farr. We'll be back next week. Bye.
That's a wrap for this episode of the Farcast. Thanks to our guests, Jim Labenthal, Dan Mahaffey, and special guest, Dr. Jeffrey Lacker. And thanks to you, our listeners. We hope you enjoy the show as much as we enjoy making it for you every week, and and please share us with friends and colleagues. Farcast comes to you weekly and is produced by Michael Farr and Harry Jennings and is available for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and all major podcast platforms. We love hearing from you every week, and you can reach us at hjennings@farmmiller.com. Let us know any questions you have and topics you'd like to hear us cover. We'd like to remind you that the Farcast podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered legal or financial advice. The information, statements, comments, views, and opinions expressed and provided in the podcast, including by speakers who are not officers, employees, or agents of Hightower Advisors or Farm Miller in Washington, are not necessarily those of Hightower Advisors, Farm Miller in Washington, or any firm any of our guests may represent. Any mention of a specific security should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell, and please be aware that past performance is not a guide to the future performance of any security, index, fund, manager, or strategy. We strongly recommend you review with a financial professional before you make any investment decision. And if we can be of assistance at Farm Miller in Washington, please reach out to me at hjennings@farmmiller.com. We are here to help, and I'll be happy to put any of our listeners in touch with one of our investment professionals for a complimentary review of your portfolio and your investment goals. Take care, stay safe, and stay healthy. Go beyond the headlines each week with the Farcast. Wall Street, Washington, and the world. Farm Miller in Washington is a group comprised of investment professionals registered with Hightower Advisors, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. Some investment professionals may also be registered with Hightower Securities, LLC, member FINRA, and SIPC. Advisory services are offered through Hightower Advisors, LLC. Farm Miller in Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC have not independently verified the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Farm Miller in Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC, or any of its affiliates, make no representations or warranties expressed or implied as to the accuracy or completeness of the information, or for the statements or errors or omissions or results obtained for the use of this information. Farm Miller in Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC, or any of its affiliates, assume no liability for any action made or taken in reliance on or relating in any way to the information. This podcast and materials contained herein were created for informational purposes only. The opinions expressed are solely those of the authors and do not represent those of Hightower Advisors, LLC, or any of its affiliates. Farm Miller in Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC, or any of its affiliates do not provide tax or legal advice. This material was not intended or written to be used or presented to any entity as tax or legal advice. Clients are urged to consult their tax or legal advisor for related questions.